From west to east and kingdom to kingdom, you're listening to the Diz Unplugged Connecting with Walt podcast. Connecting with Walt is brought to you by Dreams Unlimited Travel, experts at helping you plan the perfect Disney vacation. Visit them on the web at dreamsunlimitedtravel.com. Hello and welcome to episode 43 of the Diz Unplugged Connecting with Walt podcast. I am your host and Diz historian, Michael Bowling, and I am joined by my co-host, producer, and good friend, Craig Williams. Craig, how are you today?
I'm doing good. How are you, Michael?
I'm doing well. I think, I know you're getting over a bout of that terrible flu that's going around.
Yeah, I don't remember how many times I've been sick, and I think one of these episodes already I said I get sick once a year, and it's really bad, but then I get over it, and I can already say that 2018 is proving that wrong, so.
Oh gosh!
Yeah,
and we're barely a month into it.
Between the travel that's already been happening, the ups and downs, and the weather, and just the stress of the start of the year, I am hoping that once all of that goes away, I will just fall back into good health. But at least I can say honestly that of all the stressful things we've done at the start of the year, this show, recording it weekly, has not been one of those. This has actually ended up being way easier, I think, than you and I ever expected. So.
Well, I don't know yet. We'll see.
Well, on my end,
give it a little more time.
See, I just show up and I'm pretty and I hit the record buttons. It's so...
Well, then you put it all together at the end. So that's a lot of work to do. But and I know that out of Walt Disney World, the it's like the first half of the year is nonstop with special events. What do they call it? The Festival of the Arts?
Well, yeah, Festival of the Arts. Yeah.
Then there's my favorite, the Flower and Garden.
Exactly.
Festival. And then when is Food and Wine?
Food and Wine doesn't start again till August, but of course this year we're also going to have Toy Story Land opening up in May, so we're like Festival 1 is covered, then we'll go straight into Festival number 2, then we'll go into Toy Story Land, which is going to be very exciting, and oh man, and I'm sure there's going to be way more surprises along the way than just couple things, and that's just on the Disney side. I still have Universal to also worry about, too.
That's true. Yeah, Disneyland has a lot going on this year, too. Of course, they have all their different cultural festivals. They're doing the Lunar New Year Festival as when we're recording this, which is always really well done. And, and of course, we're going to have our Pixar Fest.
Yes, yeah.
That I'm just really excited about. And then, of course, we have our Food and Wine earlier in the year.
Exactly, yeah.
So
that conveniently ends the day before Pixar Fest begins.
Yeah, isn't that nice?
Yeah, I think everyone probably is going to book that last weekend there. Mm-hmm. So that way they get their taste of Food and Wine and then it can roll right into Pixar Fest.
Exactly.
If I wasn't coming off that Italy cruise just a week before that, I wish I could be there so badly. So. Yeah. I love a good fireworks show at Disneyland, and at least from the ones I've seen, you can always guarantee that on the debut night, they will do whatever it takes to shoot off the fireworks, even if it's not safe. So that's a one time you can guarantee to see it, is on the debut.
Oh, that's funny. So, well, a few weeks ago when I was out in Orlando to spend a few days with Craig doing research for the show, and of course I appeared in our Walt Disney World show to announce that Connecting with Walt would be a weekly show, Craig and I had the good fortune to meet with our friend, Disney historian and author Jim Corcus, to talk about his latest book, Call Me Walt, Everything You Never Knew About Walt Disney. And Jim has written more than 20 books and hundreds of articles about all things Disney for the past 35 years. And what makes his writings unique from other writers is that he has met and interviewed many of Walt's original animators and Imagineers. So this means that the stories Jim shares comes directly from those who worked with Walt Disney. So Jim has stories you won't find anywhere else. And he shared several of those stories with me and Craig, and now with you. All right, well, today, Craig and I are taking advantage of being in Walt Disney World.
Yeah.
And we are here with a Diz favorite, a Connecting with Walt favorite, Disney historian and author and speaker, Jim Korkus. Jim, welcome back to Connecting with Walt.
Well, thank you, Michael. Thank you, Craig. And yes, I'm really in the flesh. It's not over the phone anymore. And yes, we're at Walt Disney World, which is the most magical place on earth.
That's right.
Disneyland is the happiest place on earth, but Walt Disney World is the most magical place on earth. And we're at the very magical French Quarter, which has gone under some renovations, which were very surprising to me, but it also reminds me that Walt Disney World is constantly changing, and we've certainly seen that this last year, and certainly this coming year with the introduction of Toy Story Land, and then next year Star Wars Galaxy Edge, and all of these other things, and so it just flies by very quickly. So it's very important to document what we know. So thank you, Michael. Thank you, Craig, for documenting this thing for future generations. They can go back and take a look at your podcast and find out what the heck was going on.
Yeah, it's funny you brought up how Walt Disney World is the most magical place on Earth, because I was with a friend yesterday who is a cast member at the Magic Kingdom, and we were going through the what we would call Disneyland, the Disneyana shop. And a brand new collectible coin came out, and I guess he collects coins. Mm-hmm. So he was looking at it, and it's for Walt Disney World, and it said, and a friend of his who was a cast member who was on duty showed it to him, and it said, the happiest place on earth. And I said, isn't it Disneyland? And they just both looked at me and said, yes.
well, and again, you know, that's why it's very important for me to try to be accurate. So when I write books or when I write articles or even when I do a podcast like this, I try to be as accurate as I possibly can, because it all just sort of blends together. And I'm as bad as anybody else. I still refer to it as the Disney MGM Studios rather than Disney Hollywood Studios, and I probably will until the day I die. But yes, a lot of things just flip back and forth. And again, people are constantly referring to it as Disney World rather than Walt Disney World. So, and what happens is the more usage that happens, the more it becomes, just like the man who shot Liberty Valance, you know, moral of that story is that sometimes the legend becomes the truth. And so that's what often happens with Disney nomenclature and Disney history. So it's important to try and get that recorded down so we can have that for use in the future.
Well, and speaking of which, in terms of recording things, getting and getting the story straight, talking about a new book that's perfect for our show that you wrote. It's entitled Call Me Walt, Everything You Never Knew About Walt Disney, by Jim Korkus. This is a great little book. And so what we're going to do today is talk a little about, we're going to talk about Walt Disney and talk about a few of the things that you've written about in your book, and enough to whet people's appetite.
Well, and again, I think it's an important book, even if I'm the one who wrote it, because there's so many biographies of Walt Disney out there. You know, in fact, in my home library, I easily have about two dozen or more, and some of them are foreign biographies. There were biographies written in the Soviet Union and in France and all that. But there are also those what are called juvenile biographies that are often sort of a Cliff Notes version of Walt's life for younger kids and preteens to read and get a sense. And so there really wasn't a need for another biography, because there's some good ones out there, but there's some really very, very bad ones.
Yes.
But all of them seem to define Walt by what he did. So when people say the name Walt Disney, immediately we think, oh yes, creator of Mickey Mouse. He made Disneyland, audio animatronics, the first Technicolor animated feature, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And my gosh, he certainly had more achievements than almost anybody else in the entire history, you know. But everybody defines it, Walt, by that, and they don't look into Walt as a person. Who was this person? How tall was he? How much did he weigh? Did he like cats as well as dogs? What cars did he drive? You know, where did he go buy his clothes? Things like that. And I think Walt has been the subject for an awful lot of attacks recently, you know, and the feeling of, oh yes, well, nobody could be that good. He must have had a dark agenda, you know, and all of this. And that was just simply not the case. You know, the Walt that you saw doing the introductions on his weekly TV show was really pretty close to exactly who Walt was, his sense of optimism, his friendliness, his curiosity. All of that is his sense of humor. Even about himself, that's all very evident in those introductions. He's not portraying some character. That really is Walt. And so I thought it was necessary, because we have so many people, especially recently, who knew Walt personally and worked with Walt, who have passed away. Just Marty Sklar recently, you know, very unexpectedly. Who was always a great spokesperson for Walt in terms of saying, no, this is what Walt might have thought. This is how Walt worked through things. But, you know, we've had Jack Lindquist pass away, all of this. And so we're getting to that point, because Walt has been gone for half a century now. We're getting to that point where we're losing all of those people who actually knew him and who could stand up and say, no, look, this is what I saw. And we're falling into a situation where we've got an awful lot of pseudo-experts who are saying, no, this is what he thought. This is what he did. In fact, most of the people who knew Walt, and I didn't know Walt, but I was just as upset as they were with the PBS documentary.
I was just thinking about that. I was going to bring it up.
Where they pulled in some experts who had never met Walt in his entire life, and yet they're speaking with great authority of, well, this is what Walt was thinking at that time.
And psychoanalyzing.
And making those jumps and making the every person I talked to who knew Walt said nobody knew what Walt was
exactly.
thinking. Jack Hanna, who is a Disney legend and an animator who animated on the Donald Duck shorts and then directed a lot of those, and he said, Jim, nobody knew what Walt was thinking. You could bring him something and say and think, well, Walt loved this the last time, so this is what... And he said Walt would tear it to pieces, and you'd be standing there with your jaw on the ground of, what happened now? Mm-hmm. You know, because Walt was always thinking ahead, always thinking, and constantly evolving, constantly changing. So his core values always remained the same, but he always adapted to what the world was around him, and how entertainment was changing, how audiences were changing, you know. And You know, Michael, one of the questions people often ask is, well, Jim, how did you end up in this position to talk about Walt Disney, to talk about, the Disney theme parks and all of that? And, it all started off with me being growing up in Glendale, California, which is adjacent to Burbank, California, where the Disney studios are. And in fact, it is so adjacent that where I lived in Glendale, it was only a 10, maybe 15-minute drive tops to get to the Disney studios, if that's where I wanted to go. And fortunately, a lot of the animators and Imagineers lived in the Glendale-Burbank area. So when I was about 12, 13 years old, I really wanted to be a cartoonist, really wanted to be an animator. And so I was able to watch, the weekly Disney television show. And when they did a show devoted to animation, I would watch the credit crawl at the end, and then I would rush and get my school notebook, and I would try and scribble down as many names as I could. And I was dumb as dirt, so I had no idea what the difference between a layout artist and an animator or an assistant or anything. I just wrote down the names. And then I went to the Glendale Burbank phone book, and I would look up these names, and I would phone them up. And I would say, I'm Jim Korkus, and I'm interested in being an animator, and I saw your name on TV, and could you explain to me, And roughly about 85% that I called up were very friendly, were very gracious, were very patient. There were another 10% who thought it was some type of gag, because in animation you often play jokes on your friends, and so they thought they had set up some 12-year-old kid to phone them up and say, "Gee, I like your cartoons," and then about 5% were wrong numbers. And so fortunately, I was able to meet some of these people, and they were gracious enough to talk with me and to put me in touch with other Disney artists. But again, that was not what was my career goal was going to be. I wanted to be, a rich and famous actor and have, naked starlets throwing themselves at me. That was my dream. So I was in a lot of school productions and little theater productions and all of that. And I even did some TV work and film work as well as stage work. I was a winner on the Gong Show with my brothers as the Quasimodo Belairs, singing, dancing hunchbacks. Quasimodo, do you know who's going to win the third race? No, but I got a hunch. And I was on the Dating Game with my brothers and on Family Feud. And I was actually on a Chuck Barris game show called, which was very short-lived, called Camouflage, where I won a red Cadillac from Casa de Cadillac. And again, since I was a professional actor, since I was in AFTRA, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, I was making a scale, for doing this, because sometimes game shows want professional actors because they can follow directions better and they can also, give a more exaggerated reaction so that people at home, can. So, for instance, when I won the Cadillac, I threw myself on the car and kissed the windshield and all of that. And I could see the director and producer behind the camera, nodding their heads and thinking, we're going to invite this guy back for another show because, this is going to play really, really well. And so I also wrote and directed and performed shows at Six Flags Magic Mountain, and the big joke in California was, gosh, Jim Korkus is the most Disney guy we know, but he's not working for Disney; he's working for everybody else. I was writing comic books for Warner Brothers, Tiny Toon comic books for distribution in Germany and France and Italy, because they publish comic books weekly rather than monthly or bimonthly as they did out in the United States. So they needed more stories to fill all of that. And then, of course, in 1995, both of my parents developed health problems, congestive heart failure. And staying in Los Angeles was not an option because the smog aggravated respiratory problems. And if any of you have actually been in Los Angeles, you know that there's a, even though California is supposed to be laid back, there's that tension that there is. So we moved out to Orlando because my brother Mike had already moved out and he was working in Streetmosphere at Disney MGM in 1989 when the studios opened. He was there as a Streetmosphere performer as a cowboy with a huge lasso. And my other brother Chris had moved out to work at the Gourmet Pantry at Downtown Disney. I don't know if anybody listening remembers when that was there. That's now the home for the Earl of Sandwich. But it was the Gourmet Pantry, which was the they would make sandwiches and things like that. And then both of them moved up in the company. My brother Mike eventually moved up to be the casting person for all of Walt Disney World, and actually was the maintenance director for Voyage of the Little Mermaid and the Indiana Jones stunt show and things like that. He just recently retired this last summer. And then my brother Chris moved up into a variety of positions, and currently he's working with ESPN merchandise, allocating, you know, which merchandise goes to which location, because some areas sell more T-shirts and some more hats and things like that. Neither of them have ever read anything I have ever written, even though I mention them in my books. Sometimes I dedicate my books to them. I list them in the acknowledgments. They are just not readers. They are just not, and they're just not Disney fans. They like Disney, but they are not avid Disney fans. And of course, when I moved out, I had sold the house at a loss and had cashed in everything. And out in Orlando, unless you're working for the hospitality industry, the theme park or a hotel or a restaurant, there's just nothing, no jobs. There are really no jobs available. So I started out at Pleasure Island, doing magic and balloon animals for drunk college students. because, again, I had a background in magic. I had done magic professionally out in Los Angeles. I had a background in the circus arts. And from there, they moved me over in about 4 months, they moved me over to the Magic Kingdom, where I was the friend of Merlin the Magician doing the Sword and the Stone ceremony. Oh, yes, looking for the new temporary royal ruler of Fantasyland. Oh, yes. And on weekends, I was Prospector Pat, no gold miner in Frontierland. By golly. And then from there, in 1996, the Disney Institute opened. And because I had a background in animation, I got a job working at the Disney Institute, and I taught every animation class. I taught Voices of Disney, which is, you know, how to do character voices for voiceover. I did. I taught how to paint cells. I taught classic animation and computer animation and stop-motion clay animation and the history of animation. And then the Disney Institute, which I thought, my gosh, this is where I'm just going to live and die. You know, this is so wonderful. As Disney said, it became so successful, it could not be limited to just one location. The entire property is the classroom of the Disney Institute. And so what they did is they got rid of most of us and shuffled it off the Disney Institute to a couple of cubicles in Celebration, you know, and then eliminated classes for regular guests and just limited it to corporations, you know, to come in. And I jumped over to Disney Adult Discoveries, which is the behind-the-scenes tours for guests like Backstage Magic, Hidden Treasures of World Showcase, Yuletide Fantasy. You know, I taught all of those classes. I wrote some of them. And then I moved over to Epcot because they needed a they wanted a tour for guests. So I wrote the original Undiscovered Future World. And they liked me so much, they brought me into guest relations. And then later in as a coordinator for college and international programs. Because, again, I am a certificated teacher and I'm licensed to teach every level from elementary school up through, you know, college, and international students and college students needed to have a certain number of classes so that they could prove to their college and they could prove to their country that Disney wasn't just bringing them in to sell Mickey Mouse ice cream bars on the street, that they were actually getting some information and some instruction in how Disney did it and Disney history and all that. So I ended up teaching 250 different programs that I wrote and instructed, everything from cultural immersion to the history of Donald Duck and back again. And then I moved over to the Disney Learning Center, which was a combination computer lab and library. And they also offered classes for cast members, enrichment classes. So I taught a lot of those. And then in, 2008, 2009, where we had that big economic dip, Walt Disney World in 1 week laid off 3,000 cast members, and myself included. And so it didn't make any difference how many things I had done. It didn't make any difference how many awards I had gotten. It didn't make any difference how many, you know, guest accolades I had in my... It came down simply to a question of money, you know. We're going to cut things. But again, I was... in retrospect, I was very clever. I was able to separate the Disney brand from the Disney business. The Disney brand is that pixie dust, the characters, the films, the parks, that feeling you have when you're in a Disney theme park, which is different than any other outdoor entertainment venue experience, and the Disney business. So you can love the Disney brand, but still have concerns how the Disney business operates. And so as a result, I'm on good terms with Disney. And so they've brought me back, and I've written and narrated videos. I've written articles for magazines. I write a quarterly column for the Disney Vacation Club magazine, Disney Files, which I love tremendously because I find that DVC members really have that Disney magic. You know, when I meet with them, they really have that hunger for Disney knowledge and just the love of the park, and feel that the more they know, it enhances the experience. And as a result of being laid off from Disney, it then gave me the opportunity to write books, because if I was still a Disney cast member, I would have to send that through Disney for approval, and not just the approval of the facts, but the approval of what Disney wants to wants the story to be. So, for instance, an example is they may not want me to write about Mickey Mouse in the 1930s because what they're selling is the new Mickey Mouse cartoons on the Disney Channel. You know, that is the Mickey Mouse that they want to promote. And in fact, we're seeing that come in as a new attraction at the studios. And so, you know, you have to be careful that way. But now that I'm no longer a Disney cast member, I can write what I want. but I try and stick to historical material. I try to stick with stuff that is as accurate as I can get it. And sometimes it's difficult being accurate because the Disney Company has always been one that has rarely documented because they've been so busy doing, you know, that there isn't the time or the money to have somebody set aside and write, you know, this stuff down. And even when Walt was alive, it was an oral history. If you came and you had a question about Steamboat Willie, they'd say, oh, well, just go talk to Ub Iwerks down in Special Processes. He worked on that. He can tell you, you know. But what happens is even when you talk with people who were there when something happened, sometimes they only saw their part of it. Or they misremember. I find that when I interview people who had a career both at Disneyland and at Walt Disney World, is they'll misremember something about a particular attraction. You know, when I ask them about it at Walt Disney World, they'll be telling me about what it was like at Disneyland. And so you have to go through and try and confirm as much of this as possible. And as the years pass, this becomes more and more difficult, you know, to do. You know, we've even lost so much of our recent Disney history, you know, even about Pleasure Island, you know, where it has, to me, that's recent history. But for a lot of Disney fans, that's just sort of, you know, a very fuzzy, blurry type image. And, you know, you've moved on to Disney Springs now. And, of course, all of this has led me to the ultimate, which is doing this podcast with Michael and Craig. And so this is the cherry on the ice cream sundae of my life here.
Thank you. Well, and I do think for one of our purposes of the show is that I think in order to understand what a person has accomplished, you have to understand the person. And so that's why I wanted you to talk about mm-hmm. your background. And also, that's why I wanted to talk about the book, Call Me Walt, Everything You Never Knew About Walt Disney, because I agree, in order to understand what he accomplished, you have to understand the man. And I think that's what I enjoy so much about your book, is you really focus on the man and his life influences that then influenced what he was able to achieve, influenced his interactions with the people that he sort of tasked with carrying out his vision. And what's interesting is you really find out in your book how complex Walt was and that he's not easily definable as a person.
No, he isn't. And in fact, many of the people that I interviewed said, you know, Walt was different, a different person to different people. And that didn't mean that he was deceptive. That didn't mean, you know, that he was untrue to his core beliefs. And but it was that he could read people very easily. So he knew that this person would respond to praise. This person would respond more to being put in competition with somebody else. This person would be respond to having them stretched, you know, beyond their comfort level. You know, John Hench once told Walt when he was working on Fantasia that he really didn't want to work on Fantasia because he wasn't interested in ballet. And Walt says, let me change that. And so Walt immediately picked up the phone and got him season tickets to the ballet and made arrangements so that he could sit backstage. So Hench was there for all of these ballets and he would be sketching backstage. And Hench says, I fell in love with ballet. and I learned concepts that I could then apply to my design work and all of this. And he says, I never would have done that on my own. But Walt saw that in me, that if I had been given that opportunity and if I was pushed, I would go in that direction. And yes, Walt was, Diane, his daughter, who I was very privileged to know, said, yes, Walt was as simple as you think, but he was also as complex, you know, as you think. And even though he seemed like this charming extrovert. He was very private. He was also very self-conscious. He was self-conscious about how he sounded. He didn't think that's why he didn't want to be the host of his TV show. He didn't think he was good enough. You know, he thought that he didn't speak well enough. And in fact, oftentimes during the taping, he had a assistant there who would stop him and said, you know, you misspoke this word, or you know, whatever, so that they could go back and do that, because Walt wanted to present a very good image. In fact, one of the innovations that Walt rarely gets credit for is building a brand. You know, he literally told Marty Sklar one time that, you know, I'm not Walt Disney anymore. You know, I do things that Walt Disney, I don't want Walt Disney to do. I smoke, I drink, I swear. He used, you know, mild swear words. Frank Thomas, the animator, told me Walt maybe knew about four or five that he used. And he said they're really pretty, you know, lame compared with what, you know, people use, but that was not the brand of Walt Disney. But again, the downside to that is he created this brand of this man based on him. You know, a lot of that were his elements, so that now it's very easy for people to attack the brand. Oh, yes, he's not as good as, you know, nobody could be that good, you know. And as we'll talk about in the podcast, he certainly had his flaws. But, you know, basically he was a good man and he wanted other people to be happy. And as you said, you know, who he was oftentimes influenced what he did. You know, the whole Florida project out here wasn't a case of, well, this is a man who's looking to get more money, you know. Off of this project, this is a man, you know, who's trying to take advantage of things and do that. No, he was doing this because he thought this is going to improve the world. I'm going to have an area that's a living laboratory that people can come visit, and whatever they see that they feel they can use, they can take back to their own cities. And it's going to be a living laboratory because it's going to be constantly changing, because new things are going to be developed. And he really had that belief that there really was a great, big, beautiful tomorrow shining at the end of every day. And he felt, I'm going to help people find that. It wasn't a case of, yes, let's put more money in the Disney pockets. A lot of people don't realize that personally, he was in debt until about 2 years before he passed away. And in fact, everybody, including his daughter, agreed that if he had lived longer, he would have gotten in debt again. Mm-hmm. Because he was constantly, and he wasn't spending that money on himself, he was spending it on the company. He was spending it on projects. And he was spending it on other people. Sometimes people would write to him that he had known in his early years, and he would send them money to help them out, and again didn't make a big deal about it. And in fact, before the podcast started, you and I were talking about his charity work, which he did very, very quietly, so people didn't know. My gosh, really? Yes, he gave money to a Jewish old age home and a Jewish orphanage and the Boys Club and the National Blindness Association and the Jewel Stein Eye Center and the John Tracy Clinic for the Deaf. And this money was not, you know, this is from the Disney company. This was from Walt's personal wallet, although he never hesitated to leverage his resources. And so Moochie of the Mouseketeers said that Walt would always come and ask the Mouseketeers to go and perform for the John Tracy Clinic. And he said, and we did that. We didn't get paid for doing that. We did it because Walt asked us to do that. And oftentimes it was a fundraiser, you know, to bring in money. And he said, you know, what people didn't see is that Walt wasn't sitting there in the front row, you know, orchestrating this. Walt was cleaning tables and scrubbing dishes in the kitchen, you know, despite the fact that, you know, this is one of Hollywood's leading movie producers, and certainly it also had made a financial donation to this charity, and yet he's down there rolling up his sleeves and doing this, you know. I got to see thanks to Diane, I got to see some of the Disney family movies. And one time when Walt went back to Marceline to dedicate a park that was in his name, he stopped at this children's hospital. And it is so touching that you see that when he comes to the bed, he bends down so that he's eye level with the child, and he takes the child's hand in both of his hands, you know, and cradles it and just smiles and look, and this is a child who, you know, may not be there the following year, and Walt is giving him his full time, his full attention. And this is who Walt was. Now, that's not to say that Walt should be put up for sainthood or whatever, but this was a man who enjoyed children. He enjoyed older people. His wife Lillian said when we went to travel, he loved talking to older people about their lives. He loved listening to other people. Tell me your story. What, you know, I'm interested in what you think. And that's something that happens consistently. So, and he's doing this out of the spotlight. You know, one of the favorite pictures of Walt that I have is a casual snapshot that was taken by the photographer at Disneyland, where Walt is bending down on Main Street out in front of City Hall, picking up a piece of trash to put in the trash can. Ron Heminger, who got his start working at the... his dad was the Indian chief at the Indian Village at Disneyland. And so in the summers, Ron would go and work as a dancer. He eventually worked his way up into Disneyland management and then Walt Disney World management. And he said one time he was walking down... Main Street with Walt and with some of the executives. Every Wednesday was called the Park Operation Committee, and so early in the morning, Walt would walk through Disneyland with the executives and say, you know, I want this done. Let's move this. And he said, Walt was at the front, and he says, I was a junior executive, so I'm in the back, and he said, I saw Walt cross in front of all of them to pick up a piece of trash and put it in the trash can, and one of the senior executive said, well, Walt, we have maintenance people who can do that. And he said, Walt reamed him out right then and there. He says, I was surprised he didn't fire him on the spot. And he said, we should never ask other people to do what we're not willing to do ourselves. And what is our job? Our job is Disneyland. And part of that job is keeping Disneyland clean. And we need to do that as well. Walt had that firm belief. He was a passionate man. He was not as articulate as he would like to be. Marty Sklar jokes that when Walt would talk, he said, I often had to write speeches for him and things like that. And he said, the word that I constantly would come up with is the word that he would always use, which is things, because he would say, like, yes, we're going to open up the Pirates of the Caribbean, and there's going to be a fire, and there's going to be the fort, and there's going to be all these exciting things. And he said, Walt would use the word things, and your imagination would just explode. It would go wild because he saw it, but he didn't know how to always communicate it to other people.
Mm-hmm.
So now, in writing your book, did you discover anything about Walt or his life that surprised you?
Oh my gosh, constantly. You know, it actually, the subtitle should be "Everything Jim Corcus Never Knew About Walt Disney" before he started writing this book. Several things stuck out. One was if somebody had come to me and supposedly Jim Corcus is this big, you know, oh yes, Jim Corcus, you know, knows all. No, there's so much Jim Corcus doesn't know. If they'd come up and said, well, Jim, tell us about Walt's hobbies. You know, of course, I would have talked about polo. I would have talked about trains. You know, I might even have talked about his love of miniatures. And I've actually seen some of the miniatures that Walt made. And they're just beautiful. And you imagine, how can someone do something, you know, that precise? One of the things that I didn't realize was in the last few years of his life, his big hobby was lawn bowling. Now, lawn bowling is you have a ball, which is sort of about the size of a grapefruit, and you toss it, and it's irregular, and you know, how close you get to the other lawn bowl, you know. And so, in some ways, it's sort of a unusual sport, and yet he played that down at the Smoke Tree Ranch. He actually designed the lawn bowling course that's down there. He played lawn bowling with a Beverly Hills group. In fact, he paid for them in 1964 to go to a championship in Pennsylvania that Walt participated in, and was making plans to go to a tournament in Australia when he passed away. And he had his own little leather bag. And here's something that most people don't know. When Walt passed away, the players on the Beverly Hills team created, and it's still in existence today, an annual international lawn bowling tournament named in his honor. And the trophy has at the bottom of the trophy Walt's personal four lawn bowls, and at the top this statue of gold statue of Mickey Mouse and the image of Walt Disney on this. And it's like, how many people would have thought Walt Disney and lawn bowling? What is that? And again, you know, we all know Walt's love of dogs, you know, and there's so many great stories about Walt and dogs, but he also liked cats. Diane was telling me there were many cats in the house, and oftentimes they loved to just, Walt had a favorite leather chair that he liked to sit in at home, you know, to read scripts. And the cats would come up and curl up in his lap while he was reading. And I discovered, and here's something I never knew before, too. I discovered this very tragic story, is he had this black cat called Manxie. And he even wrote to, I later found out as I was doing the research, he wrote to his mom about it. And unfortunately, one time when the gardener was there working, the cat crawled into the gardener's truck and fell asleep. And then when the gardener finished and pulled out, you know, and was out in traffic, the cat woke up and panicked and then just jumped out of the truck and was never seen, you know, again, you know. And that's a story that I don't think appears anywhere else, because so many things happened in Walt's life that even when you're writing a biography, you can't get all of it, and you can't go off into those other, you know, little tangents of, you know, yes, Walt always loved to stuff his the pockets of his coat with crackers and nuts, so he had something to nibble on, and that there were certain foods that he absolutely loved, and other foods that, you know, don't ever give me this ever again, you know, for that to happen. So it was a wonderful experience for me to write the book, but it was also very frustrating, because there was so much more that I was discovering that I couldn't include, because books have to be limited to a certain size. If you go beyond that size, there is no way of recovering the cost of publishing the book. It's just that simple. And also, the larger the size of the book, the less likely people are to buy it or to read it. You know, you take a look at, there's one biography of Walt out there that's like 600, 700 pages. Mm-hmm. And believe me, I love Walt Disney, but that became a chore to go through that. And it's not because the book was poorly written or was wrong or whatever. It was just like, there is just so much, you know. The hardest thing is not what to write, but what do you have to leave out so that people get, you know, that nice little taste.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah. And yeah, and the book is, we frequently, one of the questions that I get from our listeners is they want to read a book about Walt's biography, where to start. And this is a great starting book for people who maybe they're not ready to get into that 600-page biography. This is a good one to whet their appetite, and as well as just a good one for anybody, because even if you've read all of these biographies, mm-hmm. This one has information in here that isn't in any of the biographies.
Because, again, books have a certain, even the 600 and 700-page books have a certain limit of what can you include.
Right.
Actually, one of the, when people ask me about a biography for Walt, the one that I always constantly recommend is Walt Disney, An American Original by Bob Thomas.
That's my go-to.
And the reason I recommend that, and I still recommend that today, is that Bob Thomas was a reporter for the Associated Press. Mm-hmm. And so he knew Walt Disney. He met Walt Disney. And in fact, he wrote a children's biography of Walt called Magician of the Movies. And he thought he was going to have to cut and paste that from previous interviews and all that. Walt sat down for 5 or 6 interviews with Bob Thomas just to do that, because he wanted young people to understand what it was like for him when he was young, mm-hmm. you know. And so there are things in that that don't exist in any of the other biographies. But An American Original is accurate. It's solid. Because first off, Bob had complete access to the Disney studios. He had complete access to everyone at the Disney studios. So, in fact, he interviewed people who have long since passed away, so nobody else can ever interview them and get that information. He had the full support of the Disney family. So he had access to the Disney family, he had access to their papers, all of this in terms of writing this. And Thomas said, I will write this as long as I am not restricted. You know, I'm not going to write a puff piece. And it isn't. You know, he does mention, you know, Walt had a nervous breakdown and some of these other things, but he doesn't dwell on them like it's a tabloid report. It's just another fact that happened through there. He says, I will write that, but I will only write that with no restrictions. And both the family and the studio agreed to that. When the final manuscript came in, the family said, we would like you to make 2 changes. And Bob, you know, filled with integrity, all of that, agreed to both of those changes. Now, how good a Disney historian can you be? What were the only 2 changes that the Disney family wanted in Bob's book? And I will tell you, in the edition that is out there now, both of those facts are now included in the book. Any guesses, Michael, Craig, Okay, the first one was they didn't want mentioned that Sharon was adopted.
Okay.
Because, again, that was that time period when they grew up, where there was that onus about being adopted. Even though in Hollywood that was very common, you know. George Burns and Gracie Allen, you know, adopted a son. You know, that was quite common. But again, you didn't want that publicized. And in fact, the Disney family didn't want it publicized because they didn't want Sharon treated differently. Mm-hmm. You know, so it wasn't like, oh yes, this is a deep dark secret that we're hiding. They told Sharon. They told Diane. You know, things like that. And for Diane said, yeah, they came to me and they said, you know, there are two ways of having babies. One is, you know, the mother gives birth. The other is you go and you get the baby, you know. And Diane said it made perfect sense to me. You know, that's it. I didn't see any difference. So as soon as Sharon passed away, the next edition of American Original included that, yes, she was adopted. The other one, I had no clue, and it just took me by surprise, and it only came out when Lillian passed away. She didn't want the year of her birth put in the book because she was 2 years older than Walt. Mm-hmm. Everybody assumed, well, she's the same age, or maybe she's a year or two younger. You know, obviously they're the same generation. But she was 2 years older, and she did not want to be perceived as a cradle robber.
Oh, that's hilarious, a cradle robber.
Because, again, you know, we take... we still have prejudices about age. You know, Natalie... Schaefer, who played Mrs. Howell, mm-hmm. never told her real age. And it wasn't until after she died that they found out that, you know, she was easily a decade or more older than what they thought she was. And the reason she did that is, well, they never would have hired me, and they never would have let me, you know, fall into the lagoon or whatever, because they go, oh, well, she's an old lady. We need to be very, you know... cautious about that. So, but those things, as I said, if you buy the edition that Amazon is selling right now, both that Lillian was 2 years older and that Sharon was adopted, that's in there. But again, it's a good solid look at Walt. It's very accurate. It has material that you won't find in other biographies. And again, it's something you can trust. You know, there are other books. You know, the complaint that a lot of people have about the Neil Gabler book is not the factual research that he did, some of it, which is, I think, is outstanding. What people criticize is that he makes assumptions. Mm-hmm. Oh, this happened. Walt must have been thinking this. Exactly. Or Walt, you know. And in fact, in the Gabler book, you know, he goes into... Well, Walt and Lillian really weren't in love, you know, towards the end there and all of that. And I sat down and I talked with Diane about that. He doesn't know them at all. And also, you know, different people behave differently, mm-hmm. you know, and there are changes and all of that. And it might not have been as passionate as it was in the beginning, but that's true of a lot of marriages, you know. But you could see Walt at the premiere of Mary Poppins, and he's holding, you know, her hand, and Dick Van Dyke told me, you know, at dinner, you know, they would sit close together, and he would call her mother, and, you know, mother, would you like to have, you know, such, and so, you know. But Gabler has made some assumptions. And again, here's a writer who never met Walt in person. And so that's the big thing. And again, that's true of books like the Mark Elliott book, you know, Dark Prince of Hollywood, and the Richard Schickel book, the Disney version. And in fact, in later years, I talked with Richard Schickel, and he said... I was probably too hard on Walt.
I know. I read he said he regretted that book.
Yes, because again, you get to that point where it's like, well, I'm an intellectual, and I want to prove that I haven't sniffed, you know, the pixie dust. You know, we still get that today. Oh, all those people who are Disney fans, you know, there's that sort of condescension of, you know, well, they don't really know. You know, it's sort of like a cult, and And, you know, you don't understand, you don't realize, you know, you want to prove that, well, look how superior I am and how much more intellectual I am because I don't buy into any of this stuff. Well, it's still true.
when you talk about, I know when you talk about the affection to Walt Lillian, I know that Walt felt that kind of thing was very private and personal.
Yes, yes.
But there is a beautiful photograph of them at the Walt Disney Family Museum. It's one of my favorites. It's in the section where they talk about the 1960 Winter Olympics at Squaw Valley. And it looks like somebody snapped this without their knowledge, but it's a profile of them. They're in the snow, and Walt is hugging Lillian to himself, his arms around her as if he's keeping her warm, and her head is sort of tucked against his shoulder, and his chin is sort of tucked above her head because she was a bit shorter than he was.
Yes,
and he's in his hat because he loved those hats. And it is such a beautiful, beautiful photo, but it conveys the affection and love that they had for each other and how natural it was.
You see in the book Call Me Walt that I've devoted chapters to each of the family members. So there's a chapter on Lillian, there's a chapter on Diane, there's a chapter on Sharon. There's a chapter on his mom and his dad, a chapter on each of the brothers, because, again, some people don't know he had other brothers other than Roy. And, you know, who were they and what did they do and what were the connections with that life? And there's also, you know, additional information there about his lifestyle and how, you know, at night he would always make sure he would come home at night about 7:30 at night to have dinner with Lillian. And oftentimes when the girls had left the house, they had married and left, they would eat on TV trays in front of the TV, and they would watch, they loved watching Groucho Marx on You Bet Your Life, you know. And so... it really was a nice all-American family, and again, that's, they certainly got into their arguments. You know, Lillian was always afraid that Walt was going to lose all the money. You know, when it went into sound, and when it went into color, and then when it went into feature films, and then Disneyland, and boy, she opposed all of that, and thank heaven she did, because by doing that, it forced Walt to really focus. I really have to prove that this can be done. So I've really got to go and dot the I's and cross the T's instead of just this big dream. I've got to make sure that, yes, this is workable, and I've got to be able to convince Lillian to at least say, oh, well, give it a try, you know, for that. But, yes, Walt wanted to look nice, you know, for the cameras. But, you know, there's so many of those things, like the picture that you're mentioning, that were just taken candidly. And you see the true Walt that, you know, he lived what he said. You know, it wasn't just, I'm saying this because this is the politically correct thing to do. I'm saying this because this is the right thing to say, or, you know, whatever. It's because this is what I believe, and I'm going to act it out. I'm going to follow through with this.
So Jim is a great storyteller, isn't he, Craig?
Oh, absolutely. Every time we sit down with him, it's, you just don't even know where the conversation is going, even when we do know where it's going, because you come up with the outline, it just still will take 10 different tangents, but there's always gems that you get out of it.
Oh, absolutely. And he, even before the show started, he was telling us all kinds of stories. And I just kept thinking, wait, save these for the show. Save these for the show.
I know.
And some he did, some he didn't.
Yeah, but we just to peek behind the curtain, I think we were going like maybe 20 minutes before we even hit the record. We just went naturally into a conversation, and I had to stop everything and say, okay, well, should we be recording now? And
I know.
Well, weren't we already? It's just so that's just an idea of what it's like to be in the room for one of these.
Yeah, it reminds me when I was, I don't know if I was in college, high school maybe, Katharine Hepburn is one of my favorite actresses.
Oh, yeah.
And she, towards the latter part of her life, she I mean, she just didn't do interviews. And Dick Cavett, who did had a show on, I think it was PBS at the time, and he was a very good interviewer, and she agreed to do an interview with Dick Cavett. And so they, of course, had a pre-show meeting a few days before they were supposed to record their interview for his show. And so she comes strolling by, and they sit down and start talking, and somebody decided to roll the cameras. And basically, they did the whole interview in what was just supposed to be like a pre-production meeting.
Oh, wild.
And it was a fantastic interview. And she was dressed very casually. She had her feet up like on the chair, and they just talked completely unscripted.
Yeah.
It was great. And that's sort of like how it is with Jim.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, you know. Yeah.
See, that's what I imagine that Harrison Ford's probably like, because everyone knows that he's like, once you get him on a talk show, he's like historically just standoffish and very reserved, doesn't want to answer everything. But just, I just have to believe that before the cameras turn on, though, and everything goes live, that he's probably just chatting away and having a good time and then changes immediately. But luckily for us, Jim just keeps up that energy throughout what ended up for us being a 2.5 hour long recording that you just got the first part of.
Yeah, yeah, and it was interesting to learn about Jim and the road he traveled to become a Disney historian and author as well. I always find that interesting, how people got to where, you know, where they are. So, and now it's time for This Week in Disney History quiz on important events of the Walt Disney Studio and the Disney theme parks. Now, the goal of this segment is to not only share historic milestones, but to stir memories and inspire conversations and just have a little fun so that our Connecting with Walt family who are listening can play along with us. And this week, challenging Craig, is our very own Jackie Gailey. Jackie, welcome to Connecting with Walt.
Thank you so much, Michael. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, you're welcome. We are delighted to have you join us today for this. And, you know, a lot of our listeners may know your name because they've seen it on all kinds of articles, or they may have seen you on our Walt Disney World show. But do you want to, you know, just tell our listeners what you do for the Diz?
Absolutely. So I write news stories and any kind of breaking news that we see. And I also write an editorial every once in a while. And I'm on the boards looking for all kinds of tidbits of information about Walt Disney World and Disney Cruise Line, everything related to Disney parks. And I also do updates on our site. So I'm always on the lookout for things that need to be updated. And I just kind of do all kinds of stuff. I'm on social media a lot for the Diz. So a lot of the tweets and a lot of the Facebook posts. And so I'm kind of everywhere.
You are. And I think you are probably the most bubbly, positive, upbeat person I know. We're happy to have you with us. So now the rules are, I'm going to state a question about an event that happened on a particular date for this week, the week of January 28th. And you get 3 points if you can answer the question without asking to hear the multiple choice options. You get 2 points if you want me to give you the multiple choice options. And if you want me to take away one of the options so that you have 3 left, then you get 1 point. But I'm changing it up a little. Let's say that Craig gives the wrong answer and you know the right answer. You can steal it and answer it, and then you'll get a point.
Oh.
Okay. And Craig can do the same as well. Yes. So
good change.
Yes. So yeah, so makes it a little more interesting. So okay. So are you both ready? Oh, and no Googling, especially for our friends at home.
I'm all ready.
Okay. All right. So let's start January 28th. So on January 28th, 1980. Oh, I should start. Jackie, since you are our guest, would you like to take the first question or pass it on to Craig?
Oh. And I don't get to hear the question first, huh?
No.
Oh, man. Well, I think I'll let Craig do it so I can hear.
Okay. Good, so, Craig, this is for you. On January 28th, 1982, this Disneyland cast member gave his last performance.
I'll go multiple choice.
Okay. Is it A, Wally Boak, who was the original Pecos Bill at the Golden Horseshoe Review? Or B, Bob Penfield, who began working at Disneyland on opening day, operating the King Arthur Carousel? C, Ron Dominguez, who began working at Disneyland on opening day as a ticket taker and would eventually become vice president of Disneyland? Or D, Tom Nabb, who became Disneyland's first Tom Sawyer in 1956 and would eventually manage various Disneyland attractions? He would later become the manager of distribution services at Walt Disney World.
I'm going to have to go with A, Wally Boak, because I've never heard of the other people, so I feel like that would be very obscure.
Okay. And you are correct. It is Wally Boak. He was the original Pecos Bill. He gave 39,522 performances at the Golden Horseshoe Review at Disneyland. He did the show almost continuously since its opening in 1955, and it put him in the Guinness Book of World Records for the most number of performances of a show. A party for Wally and his friends, family, and celebrities took place after the show, and he was presented with gifts and honors, including his very own window on Main Street. So, okay, so Craig, you're starting out with 3 points.
2 points, so, right?
Oh, I'm sorry, 2 points. Yes. Thank you. Look at that. I'm already off to. Thank you for being honest.
I'm not going to cheat.
I appreciate that. Okay, but Jackie, this is your chance now to pull out ahead.
I'm nervous.
Okay, January 29th, this Disney film premiered at the Fox Wilshire Theater in Los Angeles on January 29th, 1959.
Oh, gosh. I want to guess so bad, but I don't think I'm going to get it right. I better do multiple choice on that one.
Okay. So keep in mind, this is January 29th, 1959. Is it A, The Shaggy Dog, B, Darby O'Gill and the Little People, C, Sleeping Beauty, D, Third Man on the Mountain?
Okay, so the one I was thinking is not one of those choices, so I'm going to say Sleeping Beauty.
You are correct.
Yay!
It was Sleeping Beauty.
Yay! So,
yeah, very, very good.
I don't know if I should tell you guys the other one I was thinking because it's so wrong. I think 59 is too late.
Were you thinking Lady and the Tramp?
I was thinking of Snow White, but I think that
Jackie.
Was...
Jackie.
That's, yeah, that's about 22 years earlier.
Okay.
Oh, man.
Oh, man. Well,
hey, you got it right. So,
yes.
There you go.
You did. Yeah, and also released with Sleeping Beauty is the live-action documentary Grand Canyon, which was directed by James Algar.
So, interesting.
So, okay, Craig, here's your chance to pull ahead here. Okay, January 30th. This memorable spectacle debuted at Walt Disney World's Epcot Center on January 30th,
1998. I'll just go multiple choice. Or no, I don't want to go multiple. Oh my gosh. This is multiple choice. I don't want to screw myself over.
Okay. Is it A, Tapestry of Nations, B, Splashtacular, C, Skaleidoscope, or D, Illuminations?
I mean, I'll just... Oh, gosh. I'll just go with Illuminations, because I feel like Tapestry wasn't closer. It was closer to the Millennium, but I thought also Redone Illuminations was, too. But I'll just go with Illuminations.
You're correct. Go with your guts. Always, it's Illuminations. This nightly show included 13 special effects projectors, theme music, 12 wire mesh grids, 180 nozzles, which created the fountains, and 783 firework pieces. There will ultimately be three different versions of Illuminations. So very good. Okay, let me jot this down. All right, now it's 4-2. So Jackie, here's your chance to tie or pull forward. Okay. Okay, January 31st. This Epcot Center attraction closed on January 31st, 1994.
Oh, goodness. See, and I am just really not a Walt Disney World buff. I'm more of a Disneyland one.
Take the multiple choice then.
I'm going to have to do multiple choice for sure.
Okay. A, Communicore East and West. B, the original Universe of Energy. C, Captain EO. Or D, the original Journey into Imagination. This is January 31st, 1994.
94. Okay, so my first visit to Walt Disney World wasn't until 2008. So I saw Captain EO, so it can't be that. I saw the original Figment, so it was not that either.
Well, this is good. Talk through it. What were you going to say, Craig?
I'm torn right now. I have to speak up on one of them. Jackie,
yeah.
You did not see the original Figment in 2008.
I didn't?
No.
Oh, no. Okay. So it wasn't the one where the Imagineer would come in and he would do a little thing with Figment. It was really cute. That wasn't the original, huh?
The original had Dreamfinder in it.
Oh, Dreamfinder. Yeah. Oh, okay. Oh, so I'm wrong on that too. Oh, man. That's a tough one. I've never even heard of Communicore, though.
It is the precursor to Inventions.
Oh, is it? Okay. I'm going to guess that one because I never even heard of that. And so if it was, you said it was 1994, it had to have closed way before I was ever there.
Okay, that's your final answer?
I guess so.
Okay, you are correct. Communicore East and West. This was originally the hub of Epcot Center, and it brought together nearly all of the ideas and concepts explored in Future World and complemented the experiences offered by the park's other pavilions. So it occupied two buildings behind Spaceship Earth. But as Craig said, in order to keep Epcot updated, Communicore would be replaced with Inventions, which would officially open to guests the following September. So very good. So
that's a wild guess because I just haven't even heard of that. And that's really interesting to know about that because I thought Inventions had been around forever and ever.
Yeah, no.
Wow.
So Communicore was very cool. So,
oh, I bet it was.
Yeah. So, okay, Craig, it's 4-4. So here we go. February 1st, these Disneyland opening day attractions closed on February 1st, 1956.
Okay, multiple choice.
A, Davy Crockett Museum and Conestoga Wagons. B, the Pack Mules and Stagecoach. C, Pack Mules and the Mickey Mouse Club Theater, or D, Conestoga Wagons and Mineral Hall?
Ooh. I'm going to go with... Okay, remove one.
Remove one. Okay, I will remove D, Conestoga Wagons and Mineral Hall.
I'm going to go with C. I have no idea, so.
Okay, Pack Mules and Mickey Mouse Club Theater?
Yeah.
That is not correct. Jackie, do you want to try? You have a 50-50 chance here for 1 point.
Gosh, I don't...
A, Davy Crockett Museum and Conestoga Wagons, or B, Pack Mules and Stagecoach?
I don't have one single clue, but I will guess the first one.
Davy Crockett Museum and Conestoga Wagons?
Yeah.
No, it is B, Pack Mules and Stagecoach.
Oh.
Close. But after new landscaping and upgrading, the attractions would reopen under the names Rainbow Mountain Pack Mules and the Rainbow Ridge Stagecoaches. Or is the other way around, Rainbow Ridge Pack Mules and Rainbow Mountain Stagecoaches. So,
cool.
Anyway. Okay, so it's still 4-4. Okay, and Jackie, it's your turn here.
Okay.
This is for February 2nd. On February 2nd, 2006, Disney announces that this attraction will close for a significant and controversial refurbishment.
I better do multiple choice for sure.
Okay, is it A, Epcot's El Rio del Tiempo in the Mexico Pavilion, B, Epcot's The Living Seas Pavilion, C, Magic Kingdom's The Extraterrestrial Alien Encounter, or D, Pirates of the Caribbean?
I don't have any idea about this one. And this is at Walt Disney World, right? Because it's the extraterrestrial.
It could be.
It could be. We weren't even in the planning stages for our first. Let's see. I'm trying to talk it out here to see when. What was that second one again?
I'll run through all of them. A, okay. Epcot's El Rio del Tiempo in the Mexican Pavilion.
Oh, that was the one I wanted to pick because that's different now. And it was different. It wasn't that when I came in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to say that one.
Okay. Final answer?
Yes.
Okay. That is incorrect. Craig, do you want to take a guess for 1 point?
Pirates of the Caribbean.
You are correct.
Johnny Depp.
That's right.
Oh my gosh, of course.
Yep, they announced that they were going to work in character plot elements from the movie series its inspiration from the original attraction.
Did it actually open with Johnny Depp in there in 2006?
In the Magic Kingdom? No. No, it was the same one, close to the same one as Disneyland's.
Okay.
It opened.
I don't think Johnny Depp was added right away in 2006. It was announced, I want to say it was around 2007 when it was opened up in it. It wasn't a quick turnaround like what's going to happen with the redhead, but it also wasn't short either.
Yeah, it was about 3 or 4 months, I think, that it took, wasn't it?
It's tough. I wasn't living here yet, so it was one way, one vacation, and then the next way, the next vacation.
Yeah, that's how I feel like I remember it at Disneyland. I feel like it, like when we first brought the kids for our first trip, I feel like it didn't have Johnny Depp, and then the next time it did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool.
All righty. What we have now, Craig has 5 and Jackie has 4. So, and I think we're to you, Craig. So here you go. Here's your chance to pull ahead. Okay, February 3rd, Disney released its 7th feature film on February 3rd, 1945.
Wait, sorry, can you say the question one more time again?
Sure. Disney released its 7th feature film on February 3rd, 1945. What was the film?
Okay. Sorry, I'm trying to be bold and just guess it without the multiple choice, because I know multiple choice is going to literally just, you probably have it, so it's going to list out like number 5, number 6, number 7, and 8. But oh man, this is all this radio silence and oh gosh, I'm just trying to get the order in my head and
yeah.
Okay, I just give me multiple choice anyway.
Okay, is it A, Victory Through Air Power, B, The Three Caballeros, C, Make Mine Music, or D, Saludos Amigos?
Gosh.
Were any of those what you expected?
Yeah, it was, for me, it was between Saludos Amigos.
Oh, well, you shouldn't tell me.
Music, and, oops.
Because sorry, I'm going to take one away. Let me take one away first. So, okay, I will take away Victory Through Air Power.
Oh, thank you. So, literally the three in my head that I was bouncing around. I'll go with Make My Music.
Okay, it's actually The Three Caballeros.
Oh. Jackie had a chance to steal it.
Oh, I am so sorry.
Oh, so. Jackie, do you want to steal?
Now that Michael gave it away.
What were you thinking it was, Jackie?
I wasn't sure of any of those, because mainly the princess movies are the early, early ones that I watched. So I would have been I would have done a wild guess on that one, actually.
Okay. Well, you know what? Since I gave it away, I'm going to give you that point, because that was my fault. So it's a 5-5.
Ooh.
So we have a tie. But yes, The Three Caballeros was part of the studio's sort of goodwill tour for South America. And of course, the film stars Donald Duck, who is joined by his old friend, Jose Carioca, and then we first met in Saludos Amigos, which was released in 1943. He represented Brazil. And then the pistol-packing rooster Panchito Pistoles represented Mexico. It would earn 2 Academy Award nominations. Make My Music was released in 1946.
Okay.
So 5-5, very good. So Jackie, I hope you'll have to join us next week to, you know, to see who becomes the winner.
I would love to do that.
Excellent. Well, we will see you next week then on our This Day in Disney History quiz. Join us next time when Craig and I continue our conversation with Disney historian and author Jim Korkus. Be sure to check out our show notes for links to Jim's book, Call Me Walt, Everything You Never Knew About Walt Disney. And we also have some entertaining links for you that Jim shared with me and Craig, and he said we could share them with you. There'll be a link to a video with Jim as Prospector Pat at the Magic Kingdom in 1985. Maybe when you watch this, you'll realize that he taught you the gold dance when you were a boy. Or Craig, maybe he let you stroke his raccoon.
I wasn't born in 1985, so I don't remember how long he said he did this, but there is a good chance that his reign ended before I made my first visit.
Okay. Well, and then we have a clip of a very young Jim Corcus on the game show, The Origins Game from 1982. It was hosted by Bob Eubanks. Some of you may know him as the host of The Newlywed Game. And that it was very entertaining to watch. And this was the pilot episode. And you might see maybe why this show didn't go into wide release. But it was still a fun show. I think I would have done well on it. Huh. So Craig, until next time, where can our listeners connect with you on the Diz Unplugged network of shows?
As always, you can find me multiple days throughout the week on all the different shows on the Diz Unplugged podcast network, the Walt Disney World show, Universal, Diz Daily Fix on the Diz, and as I always recommend, if you want to follow along on my Twitter feed, then you can do that at Teleclaster. It's where I pretend to be funny, even though I'm not. But what about you, Michael?
Too much too hard on yourself. Well, you can send me messages at michael@wdwinfo.com. I'm at Twitter. I'm at at mbowling121. On Facebook, I'm Michael Bowling. It's the account with the Connecting with Walt banner on it. Instagram, I'm Michael Bowling the Diz. And as we told you last time, you can connect with both of us on our new Connecting with Walt Twitter account. And Craig, you want to tell our listeners about that?
Yep. Of course, you can follow us along. I still don't remember if the first week I actually even gave the name of it, but we're at Connecting Walt. And so you can follow us on there. We are going through and trying to follow all the best Disney history sites that we can that are on Twitter and people involved with Disney and just in the know, interesting pictures that can even pop up, stuff like that. And we'll do our best to take all that content, share it with you along with our own. So we're still getting it off the ground running, getting through all the tweaks and adjustments of it, but hopefully we'll start being very active. And I already know we've got people following us and starting to respond. And of course, if what you say is share with us is interesting on there too, we'll retweet you, give you a little love that way. But yeah, it's follow along with us at Connecting Walt.
Great. Excellent. And if you're at the Walt Disney Family Museum this weekend on February 3rd or 4th, you may see me or Mary Jo from our Disneyland show. We are going to be there. We're going to participate in Mouse Adventure at the museum. So that should be a lot of fun. I'm sure I'll talk about it at some point on the show. I've never done a Mouse Adventure. This is a big deal at Disneyland. They're basically huge scavenger hunts.
That's what I was going to ask about. Every time I'm in Disneyland, doesn't matter if the time of year changes, it seems like always on one of the last days that I'm there, out of nowhere, there'll be all these groups running around doing scavenger hunts.
Yeah, and they're huge. And Mary Jo has participated in them for years. And I've never been in the right place at the right time to do that or been part of a team. But these are teams of two because of the size of the museum. So when I told the Disneyland crew about it, Mary Jo says she'd be on my team. So
there you go.
So cheer us on if you're there and be sure you say hello. So, and if you would like to listen to more shows on the history of Walt Disney, his studio, his Imagineers, and Disneyland, check out our Diz Unplugged Podcast Disneyland Edition archives for my Disney history episodes at www.disunplugged.com. Look for past episodes of Connecting with Walt on iTunes, where you can subscribe to our show and leave some positive reviews and ratings. So thank you for making us a part of your day. And remember, I only hope that we don't lose sight of one thing, that it was all started by a man, Walt Disney, and his brother Roy.